Laura Whitley joins the show now. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you today, Luke.
We're talking because you are in the Flashcard Project exhibition currently showing at Carbondale Arts. Maybe we can start by having you describe your piece.
Sure. So I received a flashcard that was a pine tree. And when I flipped it over, it has the image on the front side and the description on the back. And I'm reading this description of a pine tree, and I came across this note that pine trees are historically valued for their clear, straight wood. And I thought, well, that's funny that that's the value that we place on a tree exclusively. And then it got worse because it said that, but what their most important value is as paper pulp. And I was sort of stunned to think that this is what children are learning that the value of a tree is. You know, what about biological, ecological, medicinal, spiritual, all these other essences and benefits of a tree. And so that's where it all started.
So you pondered that notion for how long?
Well, for as long as it took me to do a Google search on what you use to paper pulp for. And as it sounds, you know, you make paper, but you also make toilet paper. And you have to remember that we were doing this in April in the middle of lockdown and all this toilet paper hoarding. And so I immediately thought, okay, I have found my thing. And when I discovered that it takes one tree to make 200 rolls of toilet paper, I knew I was onto something.
Wow, that's a stunning statistic. So that's one full-grown tree.
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
It's a little disheartening.
Yes.
And so that was my goal, to make a tree out of 200 rolls of toilet paper.
Huh. Oh, how about that? So that's what you actually produced. You have a tree of 200 rolls of toilet paper, but it's not a roll of Charmin that you're not supposed to squeeze. It's actually wrapped in a piece of paper with a message on it.
That's true. People have asked, where did you get the toilet paper when everybody's having such a hard time? Well, it turns out you can just order it on Amazon. Who knew? And I knew I didn't want your standard toilet paper wrapper, so I worked with Raina Katzenberger at the project shop. And she helped me do a letterpress of a quote that I love from a book called The Overstory. And so we individually wrapped each roll with this quote.
And
do you need me to say that again? Did that ding come through on your end?
No, that sounds pretty good to me, but I'm wondering if it's a spoiler to say the quote.
I'd love for people to have a little surprise to see what, to invite them into the show to see the tree, because it's
fair.
Something that really helps you think about what is the value of the tree and where is the miracle of a tree. And if trees look merely at like product dispensers, as this one is designed to be, a giant toilet paper dispenser, imagine a tree as a Pez dispenser or something, then that's what I had in mind. And if people visit, they can take a roll with them.
Yes. In fact, I have my roll in my hand as we speak.
Oh, good.
That's a fabulous book. In fact, I reread that book during the quarantine.
Isn't it amazing? I was doing the same thing for the first time. And for those of us who live here in the mountains and are surrounded by trees, it really... Richard Powers, The Overstory, really gave me a new admiration for the role trees play in life and how long they have been on the planet, especially compared to us humans. I grew up in Northern California, and my mountain landscape at the time was Mount Tamalpais in Marin County in near the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And it's where I learned how to become a mountain biker. And to get to a place where you're riding your bike or hiking, as the case may be, through a grove of redwoods was amazing. For me, it would literally stop me in my tracks. I'd get off of my bicycle and go into what's called a fairy ring, where the younger redwoods grow in a circle. And so as they grow up, there's this circular space in the middle of them. And it feels, without getting too airy-fairy, it feels very sacred.
Yeah.
To be in the presence of what feels like biological wisdom, and to be surrounded by it. And that, to me, is one of the miracles of a tree. And this piece, as anybody will see who goes to visit it and gets to read the quote, will see that miracle plays a part in this piece.
Yes, it does. As does a lot, that figures in a lot of your work, doesn't it? The idea of miracles.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never thought of it that way. There's certainly serendipity about the things that I find. Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, for instance, I checked out the ghost cabin. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's still hanging or if that was a temporary installation wherever, whatever Aspen Grove you did that in. But that's a miracle, if you ask me. It was beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Luke. I appreciate that. That piece that you're referring to was first shown at the launch pad, actually. It might have been 3 years ago.
Huh.
And it is a house made of glass, made of about 1,200 pieces of found glass from the mining era, glass shards from old bottles and the like. And after it visited Carbondale and then it was shown in Denver and it never found a home, a permanent home, I knew I didn't want to simply store it. And so I had always had this dream that the house should be in a forest. And so I was really fortunate that up at Ace's Toke Lot, they let me install it there last fall in an aspen grove. And there was, I don't know if I would say there's something miraculous, but there was something alchemical that did happen. It completely changed. In a controlled setting of a gallery, it hangs still. It doesn't move or tinkle unless somebody bumps up against it, because these pieces of glass were suspended on wire, so they could have a chime-like effect.
Yeah.
But you put it in the forest with the wind and the light, sunlight playing on it, and it completely animates. And it became a piece about sound and movement. And so I suppose for me that was astonishing to see how a sculpture can change by virtue of its setting, how much it can change, I should say.
You talk a lot on your website about the idea of giving new life to found objects, and the ghost cabin, it strikes me that the ghost cabin is a perfect example of that dynamic.
Yes, that certainly was the intention. I'm glad that you were able to experience it that way. And I hope that piece is something I want to keep transforming. I like the notion of not wasting, and to honor the embedded energy or the embedded carbon in the materials. And so my long-range goal for that piece is to keep transforming it, kind of destroying it, recreating it, destroying it, recreating it in different forms until at the very end, and I have a list that's over 2 dozen ideas long, what may be left is nothing but glass dust, which is sand, which is what it's originally made of. So I very much appreciate this notion of getting the most life we can out of everything. And I suppose for Diminishing Supply, which is the name of the toilet paper tree, the circular element of it is that these toilet paper rolls will be given away. There's no commerce involved. That it is made, it goes out into the community as gifts. So a little bit different, but there is something about knowing what we leave behind.
And not a show.
Intentional.
And not a showy, pretentious gift at all, but a very mundane, useful gift.
Yes. I figured that in this case, I was purchasing new materials, which I was able to do thanks to a patron, Susan H. Brady. But and so I wrestled with that, but I knew that these were very practical and that the worst case scenario, somebody would use them, these rolls of toilet paper, for the intention which would they were produced. So it wasn't going to go to waste.
It sounds like, Laura, that you spend a lot of time looking for these objects in old dumping grounds in and around Aspen. Is that your solace? Is that your practice? Is that your... And has that changed since the pandemic?
You know, that was my practice for a good 2 years. It took a long time to harvest those materials, forage for those materials in these old dumping grounds. And it wasn't just glass. It was all the hard bits. So also ceramic, old pieces of pottery and metal, and even the bottoms of shoes, shoe leathers, these things that endured through the weather over 100 years and through erosion. And so that was a big part of it, and I enjoyed that very much. I have now, my studio is filled with this stuff now, and I finally reached it, like, enough is enough. I don't need to collect anymore. The practice is now, how can I repurpose these items in meaningful ways?
Uh-huh. Is that a long, extended, drawn-out process, or is it the result of flashes of insight?
It is a long process, and that's mostly because I, as a working mom, I have a limited amount of time to create art, and so I call myself a slow artist. The glass house in its original form, in which it had another name called Homecoming, it was 2 years in the making. I said it was 2 years of Fridays. So everything I do takes a while, actually. But to have the prompt and a deadline from Weaver and from Brian was terrific because there was no time to lose.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Laura, because everybody else that I've talked to so far related who did a piece for this show said the same thing. It was the prompt and the deadline that you know, made it happen.
Yeah, it puts a little hustle in your step, that's for sure. it's a very positive influence.
Uh-huh. So did the pandemic and the quarantine give you time to make some art?
That's interesting. Actually, in most ways, no. My studio is up at the Aspen Community School. And even though it's apart from the school building, I respected the quarantine and the school closure.
Oh.
And so I was working from home while our son is home from college, and my husband, who's a teacher, and our other son, who's a high school student, everybody's home. And so it wasn't a setting that was conducive to making art at the time. Once I got the prompt from Weaver, then it became a little chaotic because I was building the tree in our living room. And so I'd work on the trunk, and then I'd work on the ring that is a functional piece that allows for people to take a roll out. And then I'd work on the toilet paper rolls. And it actually wasn't even until I installed at the launch pad that I saw the whole thing together. So it was a bit of chaos, and not necessarily a recommended way of working, but the job got done.
Has the quarantine and the pandemic, has it changed the way you think about your art?
Yes, actually. It's made me realize that I want to have my studio at home and to figure that out, because what the pandemic prevented me from doing was commuting to my studio, and which is about 20 minutes from my home. And when I could just drop in and pick up art making at any moment, like, oh, I have a half an hour, I'm going to work on this part of it. Hey, there's an hour, I can get this done. All of a sudden, I realized that to have immediate access was really invaluable. And our kids are, as I mentioned, one's in a high school junior, one's in college. So they're older now. So when I first began making art, which was about 12 years ago, the boys were much younger, and it was I couldn't get a clear headspace at home to make art because I was so busy tending to the kids and them coming to me and interrupting me. So it was really important to have a studio apart. And now I'm looking ahead to figure out a way to have my studio at home. And that will change another thing, which is I'll have to make smaller things. I tend to always make big things, not even meaning to. And a smaller studio usually forces you to make smaller things. And I think that will be a good thing for me.
Laura Whitley, one of your projects is the Imagine Climate Initiative. I wonder if you could describe for us what that is.
Sure. So my day job is as the Creative Strategy and Content Director at CORE, the Community Office for Resource Efficiency. So we're a nonprofit, an energy and environment nonprofit. And 3 years ago, I founded a project there called Imagine Climate. And it's an annual initiative that is a celebration of climate art and technology. And it's based upon the notion that we can use art as a tool for social change. And it complements our day-to-day marketing and advertising and promotion of climate mitigation and energy, energy improvements in buildings and the like. And it allows us to use different channels, in this case the visual arts, as a way to think about and act on climate. So we're planning the third one right now for 2021.
Oh, okay. What can you give us a sneak preview of that, or is it still conceptual?
I can say a few things. I'm not at liberty yet to say exactly what it is, except
sure.
that it will involve large-scale photography and buildings and community.
Oh.
And it will grow out, how do I say this? It will grow on the shoulders of what we did this year. People may be familiar with the Climate Billboard Project, in which four artists and four art centers collaborated with us to use these really cool pens called Air Ink that capture carbon from tailpipe emissions and transform them, process them into ink. So we used essentially carbon pollution as a black ink to make these billboards.
Oh,
and
wow.
Anybody who has visited the launch pad has seen the one by Brian Colley called Carzilla, which is on the outside of Carbondale Arts. It was also Chris Erickson who created the billboard for the town of Basalt and the art base, and artist Kelly Peters, who made one for that's at the Collective in Snohomish Village, and artist Kate Howe and the Red Brick Center for the Arts, who made one that was in the Aspen Art Museum. And all of them had the same tagline on the billboard, which was, this art is made from carbon emissions, which gave us a platform to talk about all the things that are made from carbon emissions, including more severe drought and more intense wildfires and shortening winters. And then we can start, as we start to change people's perceptions and ways of thinking about things, then we can start to change their ways of doing things. So that's the goal, ultimately, is climate action.
So that's what a creative strategy director does.
That's right.
Comes up with cool projects like that. How about that?
I love working on that project, and it was made possible by the support of many organizations. We had over 24 collaborating organizations. It was a really great public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not me alone. We're all in this together.
So hopefully you will achieve the move of your studio soon. And when you do, what's going to come out of that studio? What's next for Laura Whitley?
You know, I feel like there's something about drawing on some of these pieces of ceramic that I have accumulated in the studio. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like. And then the glass house, I hope, will continue to go through different iterations. So we'll see. I have to get in there and get to work. And that's, the ideas come from getting to work, you know, sitting
right.
down.
Right.
And
right.
Starting to move things around. And so I don't know exactly.
Well, good luck to you, Laura Whitley. Thank you for spending a little time with us. And I appreciate your art. Thank you.
Oh, it was a real pleasure, Luke. Thank you very much.